Good morning, everybody. There have been so many folks that I've talked to at Scottsdale Bible Church since the election that have said to me, I've just checked out. I don't care to watch Fox News anymore. I thought I would just go all to sports, but then you go to sports and all you have is the Suns, the Diamondbacks, and the Cardinals, and they're all in the bottom. And so you say, well, gee, that's no fun. So there's a lot of things that one learns from Wayne Grudem, and you are all privileged to be here Sunday after Sunday hearing what Wayne has to say. Let me tell you, and I don't know if Wayne has spoken to this at all as far as after the election, but of all times not to check out, this is the time not to check out. Certainly a different outcome would have been a whole lot more fun, but does any toughness and grit and even forward progress come without enormous muscle and breaking down the muscle? And so that's one thing I've learned from Wayne Grudem. Another thing that I've learned from Wayne is he says, Barry, and when things happen, discuss them, think about them, and then draw the line. Don't process so much. My wife and I like to have an event happen, and we like to talk it, and talk some more, and talk some more, and yap some more. And so we process things to death. And Wayne says, don't do that. We did a funeral in Albania. And when you die in Albania, you have to be buried the same day that you die. And the situation was that this man was at the hospital with his wife. They had a new little baby. He was there till midnight. He went home. He had a heart attack. He died. And so someone had to do his funeral, and his wife had not even been told yet. This was about 7 o'clock in the morning. And so this pastor asked Wayne and I to do the funeral. And so that afternoon at 4 o'clock, we did the funeral, and the pastor wanted to be at the hospital with the wife and sharing with her in her grief and comforting her in her grief. So Wayne and I did the funeral. It was really one of the most powerful things I've ever seen in my whole life, because Wayne was able to relate that he said, I stood in Minneapolis, and I had my new daughter-in-law coming down the aisle as I'm marrying my son and my daughter-in-law to the song, Blessed Assurance, Jesus is Mine. That's what she wanted. And a few months later, he's standing in this same church. And instead of a bride coming down the aisle, a casket is coming down the aisle because his daughter-in-law was killed in an automobile accident. Blessed assurance, Jesus is mine. We have the same comfort in joy as we have in sorrow. And it's the truth. We do have the same comfort and joy as in sorrow. So we did that funeral in Albania. And Wayne is indeed a man who practices what he preaches. We finished the funeral. We got out. It was raining. We each had an umbrella. We walked about one block and we said, this is not going to work. It was raining that hard. We better duck inside a hotel. So we ducked inside a hotel. And Wayne said, you know, we haven't had an ice cream sundae since we've been in Albania. Would you like one? And I said, I'd love one. And so they brought a sundae, and it was this tall, each of us, this tall. And so just that alone is enough to make you smile. And I've just never seen Wayne enjoying anything so much in my life as he's eating through this sundae. And about halfway through, I said, Wayne, don't you want to talk about the funeral? Because for me, I'd like to talk about the funeral all day long now. And Wayne said, we did what we could. We allowed God to use us. We entrusted it all in his hands. There's nothing more in our hands. There's just nothing more. So we're not going to process it. So once again, just in little details of life, I think one of the things that I go away with after 2 or 3 years with Wayne Grudem is not processing. I was told when I got in this book with Wayne that you guys are going to end up not as friends. Here's the reason. Because art by committee is not art at all. So you've just finished your painting, and as if I could step over your shoulder with my black and my yellow and say, no, I think this. So art by committee is not art at all. And writing by committee is not art at all. It's very personalized. It's what we do. It's the very essence of our being. But to start interfering with someone else's writing usually doesn't work, and it ends up in not being friends. But no one has done that with Wayne Grudem before, I guess, because he has not co-authored, as you know, many, many books. But it worked just splendidly. Wayne would let me have the first shot at it, and then he would take it and take a Volkswagen and make it into a Mercedes, or take a piece of junk and make it into a Lexus. And so he would do that over and over. The one chapter that I knew that Wayne couldn't do that on was on freedom. I've done more on freedom than any other word in the dictionary. Probably worked 30 years on that. And I had 15 main points that I wanted to make on freedom. And I think I had them honed down about as good as I could. I hand it to Wayne. He begins to readjust all 15. And then he adds another 18. I said, 18? I've thought about this all my life. How did you come up with those? Well, that is the magic of Wayne's wonderful mind. He literally can take something, improve it. And so what a total joke of being a co-author. It's just total. So I don't know. You ask Wayne if he'd ever do that again. I don't know. And let me know if he'd ever do that. But from my perspective, we have ended as, and not ended at all, but we're still best of friends. We got to take some trips around the world. We've got to go look at some poverty with our own eyes. But all that said, at the end of the day, we're both white guys. We're both old. We're both Christians. And I tell you, to understand something about poverty, you have to live in that culture for weeks and months and years to begin to understand poverty. So in no way did we act like we somehow had some kind of insight into poverty. But here's what we did have insight into. Is that if you can help the poor to have them stop thinking of themselves as victims, but indeed men and women created in the image of God, who, because God is a creator, they too can become a creator, an entrepreneur, and a producer. And so when you come from that position, it's just easy to stand in front of any kind of an audience and say, any one of you can learn to produce, create, make something. And as you do that, you add to the wealth of the country. And so it was so nice to have that focus as we began the book, that we're going to write chapter after chapter, but the underlying point behind the chapter is, could this, might this, would this, will this somehow help you to help your nation to go from poverty to something other than poverty? And so that's the spirit of which we wrote. So when we're talking to the Africans, we say, God bless you for community. God bless you for being so loyal to your family. And we always would pick out the aspects of their culture that were the most Christ-like and God-like. But then we would say, unfortunately, in life, this lady here, the only way she's going to become more productive at her sewing is to have a sewing machine. And so when her aunt gives her $100, let her keep it. Let her keep it. Because she's going to keep that. And if she adds a little more to it, she can buy a sewing machine. And now she becomes more productive. And where in one day she would produce one, now whatever she's producing, she can produce 5 or 10 because of that sewing machine. But somehow you have to allow her to become collateralized. But the African culture does not allow that. The African culture says, at the end of the day, share it. So if my aunt gives me $100, at the end of the day, I have to share it with everybody in my family, in my near community, and so we all end up with a couple of dollars. You have a couple dollars, I have a couple dollars, but none of us can get collateralized. And so it's not easy. That's a cultural thing that you want to share and give away everything you have at the end of the day. But if you have that attitude, you will never, ever get lift off as far as lifting off from poverty. The country will always and forever be poor. Now, if that's the choice, that is fine. That's fine. But if we're interested in some economic growth, then we absolutely have to rethink that culture. And we would be the first to say, we're not here to try to change the culture. And certainly academic types, sociological types, do not ever want to let you change the culture. If the Amazon River people only live to age 25, and if the Amazon River people don't have any antibiotics, any medicine, any anything, and they die at 25 with rotten teeth, and when you're 75, when you're 25, you look like you're 75, a group of folks at the university, that's beautiful. That's a culture. That's unique. But Wayne and I say that that's not what God says. The Bible says, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and have dominion and create as God is the creator. So you can't say what other people in culture say. You say, this is kind of what, not kind of, this is what the Bible says. It's kind of interesting when you really are able to continue to come back to the Bible as your main source. And no one knows it better than Wayne. And Wayne was able to squeeze out more great verses out of the Bible into this effort of ours. And so it was a lot of fun. It's to the publisher, and we're going to be all giving you all a free copy about in June. So that's where that stands. On Thursday night, I'm going to do my economic outlook here at the church. And literally everybody asked me this question. Will there be some optimism? reality is what reality is. And there's not one thing that you can do to change that or I can do to change that. Would we all have wished for a different outcome? Would we have wished for something that would begin to create some incentives? Would we wish for a president who kind of believed in the market and believed in capitalism and believed in creativity and believed in entrepreneurship? That would be sweet. There's no doubt about it. It would be sweet. And certainly my life would be much, much easier. But I have to say that God, thank you for allowing this to come into our country and into us, because it either, you know, I know you've heard me say this before, but trials, tribulations, and adversity are frequently God's greatest benedictions, blessings in disguise. The things that we think are going to break us are often the things that make us. My feeling at the end of the election, Mandy and I made a commitment for 3 months prior to the election that every morning we were going to get up at 6 and pray for our country. And at 6 o'clock in the evening, we were going to pray for our country again. In 50 years of marriage, we've never done that. But 3 months, alarm goes off, we're going to pray for our country. So we did. So we kind of thought that with that kind of sacrifice and that kind of prayer, we just kind of thought it was going to go our way. Oh, silly us. Silly us. I have to tell you, we have a whole new set of circumstances, not only with our nation and the politics end of it, but when what I did not know, and this is due to my foolishness and my unwillingness to be as informed as I should have been, but for whatever reason, I missed it. But I had no idea that in this election, 40% of the voters would be singles. I did not see that coming at all. And I really, as I'm busy going about criticizing Western Europe for not having babies, you have to have 2.1 babies per female just to maintain your population. And Europe has been fooling around with 1.3 or 1.4 or 1.5 babies. That is to say, Europe is not replacing itself. Europe in 50 years is going to be gone and probably be totally Islamic, but that's a whole other question. So as I'm busy worrying my little body about France and Italy and Spain and Europe, and at the same time, Japan has not been replacing its population either. Women are simply not having babies in Europe and in Japan. I guess I took my eye off the ball and didn't realize that in the United States, we had the lowest birth rate per however you measure things than we've ever had in the history of the United States. So we, too, are not replacing ourselves. So that's the baby end. We are not having babies. Oh, and interestingly, we're really not having a lot of marriages either. In proportion, we're just not. I sat down just this morning and wrote, what in the world is the reason for that? And now maybe some of these are kind of silly reasons why we're not getting married and why we're not having babies. But when certainly our country compared to every other country, we have universal education, and without question, you have enough universal education. And in particular, the United States, with all the women being educated. And then as we move from an economy that used to be an economy of muscle, and that is man's comparative advantage, muscle, female's comparative advantage is balancing a lot of plates and being a multitasker. Well, guess what? The way business is going is that we need more and more people who relate, who are sensitive, who are multitaskers. And us guys would be the first to admit, please, don't make us both babysit the children on Saturday afternoon and watch Saturday afternoon football. That's just more than we can take. I mean, which is it? Do we babysit or do we get to watch football? But to do both, where it seems that females are certainly capable of doing all those things. So in my business of speaking, 30 years ago, the audience would be divided 90% male and 10% female. In the last 5 years, it would divide out probably 55-45 female and getting very close to 60%-40% female. Terrific! But it does mean that you really want more young, talented, capable, able female speakers than you do 70-year-old men that you're dragging out of a nursing home and bringing up there. So you can see how that might translate into my business. So these are just all interesting phenomena. But so universal education would be one reason why women are not choosing to marry. They're totally capable of themselves, thank you. At the very least, then, they're delaying marriage, and marriage is being delayed. They're marrying more at age 25 or 30 or 35. No-fault divorce feeds into this. The university has been legitimatizing cohabitation for years and years and years. In the business world, when you all have meetings, they used to call it your special other or something, but it's just as common to be just cohabitating as it is to be married. There's nothing special about being married. Now, as Christians, we step back from the scene and say, if we honestly had to describe why America in 240 years comes out of the ashes as a nothing and all of a sudden rises to be this incredible empire, we didn't want it to be an empire, we didn't desire it to be an empire, but when you are the strongest militarily, when you are the strongest politically, when you are the strongest economically, when you as one economy produce more goods and services than the next 8 or 10 countries combined, then indeed, really, it is an empire. You are reigning over an empire. We as Christians would say some of the reason for that is marriage and the market. Our economy has been linked to the market, the entrepreneurship, creativity, etc. And so we said that's very important. But we'd also say marriage has been the glue. Marriage that stems from what God thinks, or what God says in the Bible about marriage and male and female, and the two shall become one flesh, and what God says about family, and don't exasperate your children, the husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church, and wives, respect and love your husbands. And so we have a glue that has kept it together for us. Now, as you know, we're facing headwinds. Headwinds that we haven't really ever faced before. When the government is going to come up with massive entitlements, those entitlements in the old days, my time, that's what children were for. Children were there to support their mothers and dads into old age. Last night, I took my 96-year-old dad to dinner, and we just had a great time, and our dinner guest said, "Do you see your dad every day?" "Yes, I do." "You call him?" "Yes." "Are you usually with him?" "Yes." "Do you take him to Dunkin' Donuts almost every morning?" "Yes." "Does he have a chocolate cream filled?" "Yes." "Is that good for his health?" "He's 96. I mean, how hard is this to figure out, this correlation of what works here? And so, and they said to me, "That is so nice of you to be taking such care of your 96-year-old dad." I thought that's what I was supposed to do, first of all. I thought that's what I was supposed to. But second of all, for the kind of sacrifice that my dad and mom made for me, please. When was it supposed to be repaid back? When I was 0 to 25? I couldn't. I didn't. But when I'm older, are you kidding me? It seems like the thing to do. But when government provides entitlements for all the needs, it takes out that role of children caring for their parents. So there's a whole bunch of reasons why we're going single. We're going single because we're urbanized, and we're going single because for any one of us, to be quite honest with you, if you wanted to throw the towel in on your marriage, if you wanted to do that, you could go online with one of those dating services, and I'm telling you, they would line you up with someone so fast you couldn't believe it. Now, I'm not going to touch that kind of stuff. I even had an old girlfriend call, and I said, Joan, I tell you what, we cared for each other a lot 55 years ago. But I've been married for 50 years now. What are you trying to do here? Do you have it in the back of your mind that somehow you could maybe capsize my marriage? Why would you want to do that? I only say that we live now in an internet world where it is not hard to find a hookup. It is not hard to find someone else and else. And yet, those of us who are older, we came through marriage where you commit. And it's trustworthy. And you're not going to break that trust. And I'm just so grateful. I was a Christian through my whole married life, and I'm really grateful that God gave me the little tool of singing a song anytime I got into a tight situation. Step in an elevator, a hooker gets in there, the elevator starts going up, and I begin to sing, "There is power, power, wonder-working power in the blood of the Lamb." You know, if there's anything that ticks off a hooker more, I don't know what it would be, but talking about the blood of Christ as our salvation. So I've used it many times. I've 30 years, 40 years teaching a Sunday school class, and I've had, just this week, I had a man come up to me and say, "The little technique that you talked about 30 years ago, good, that's what Christian body is about, that we lift each other, give each other. But the point is, you make a commitment through the highs and the lows. Is marriage tough? Yes. Is it difficult once in a while? Yes. Can you get angry at your spouse? Easy to do. On the other hand, I mean, please, to give up your family, to give up marriage, to give up the children, to give up what in the world? So, us oldsters, we want to keep those relationships. But just even talking like that would describe a person that is out of a nursing home, because singles really view life differently. And as you probably know, 60% of singles voted for Obama, 30% voted for Romney. So the single vote went strongly in favor. Of course. I mean, so those are the new headwinds. So either we learn now to work with those headwinds, or we cash it all in. And I think it's silly to cash it all in. Our church wants to get good at ministering to to a lot of different groups, but certainly to the Islamic group. We found a church over in Wales that they are unbelievable at it. And so Tom and I flew to Wales about a month ago, and we spent a whole week at that church. And we wanted to figure out a lot of things, but one of them, how are you so effective with people from the Islamic faith? And every one of them had their own way, but it really did boil down to being with them, asking questions, caring about them, liking them. Friday afternoon in Wales, 30 left to go to a retreat. 15 were Muslim, and 15 were members of the church. And off they go. And I said, when are you coming back? And they said, we'll be back Saturday noon. And I said, are you coming here to the church? And they said, yeah, that's where our meeting spot is. So yeah, we all have to come back to our cars at the church. I said, could I meet with all of you just for about 20 minutes and we talk about the retreat? And we talk about what was said and what went on. And so like in anything else, it's not magic. Befriend, be kind, be nice. In that sense, I'll be honest with you how I've had to learn in this last election. I am not going to call Mormons a cult. Yes, it is, between you and me. But to call a cult, it's like it's some kind of evil. How am I ever going to show the love of Jesus if I'm not showing the love of Jesus? And there's some kind of a bad attitude on my part. Hispanics really should be a real fertile field for free market, limited government type of economics. They're family oriented. They work hard. They love God, albeit Catholic. So there's a lot of things out there that are very positive. And yet, as you know, Hispanics, once again, 70% vote for Obama, 30% vote. So is it their problem or is it our problem? And so I think, once again, it never hurts when we're pointing fingers to notice that three are pointing ourselves. So Barry, your whole language is going to have to change as you're wanting to love people. And you can't be pulling words out that are hurtful. They're not going to like you for that. And I want to show the love of Christ. And so Thursday night, I've got a little, just 3 minutes. Heavens to Betsy, don't make me go 5 minutes on this, on immigration. And we've got, as a church, talk through honestly, what do we mean when we do this? What do we mean now? I know what this means. Is there something about rule of law that you don't understand? Listen. There's a line there. You stand in line like everybody else. Why should you be special? You stand in line with everybody else. Well, you can stand in line, but what if in real actuality there is no line? In other words, you've had your children, they're American citizens now, and I'm saying you stand in line like everybody else. There's nothing wrong with that. What is there about rule of law that you don't understand? But what is it there about this that we've wanted them to do our lawns? We've wanted them to clean our homes. We've wanted them to work in our restaurants. We've wanted them to work in our cotton and our fruit fruit farm fields, etc. We really have. And every economist who has studied this has said, on a net-net basis, the benefits of illegal immigration far outweigh the costs. We know the costs, because we have to know that argument. And so we'll throw that up. What are the costs of illegal immigration? But the benefits to the economy, are you kidding me? So there's hardly an economist that doesn't come out and talk about the pluses of that. So my point of all this is not to try to change any votes, but definitely on Thursday night to share a few ideas on immigration that we all begin to change some attitudes and watch attitudes and do exactly what they do in the Wales church, and that is they love on those Muslim people. They love on them. I would rather love on you all. You know why? Because I get love back. But I tell you, to see those Muslim 20-year-olds come back from that camp and to hear what they had to say, the message of Jesus is getting through. It is getting through. It's going to be worth the effort. We're never, ever going to win them any other way than care about them as individuals also created in the image of God. Now, we're ready to get to the lesson. Did they pass out the handout yet? Did it come out? Ah, here it comes. I don't like to rush into these things. And to be honest with you, you know why I did this? So when Wayne asked you, well, because you know how he is. I mean, everything is dot the I's, cross the T's. I mean, I've never met a guy like him in my life like that. And so, I mean, oh, well, Barry just got up and started rambling. No, we went nowhere. We went absolutely, well, hopefully this has been somewhat helpful as we're looking at it. Maybe not. Wayne and I would oftentimes come in and start the lectures, and the word would get around town, and pretty soon the politicians heard it, and pretty soon, so almost inevitably and invariably, we would get to talk to the president of the country or the prime minister of the country. And so we're visiting with the prime minister of Albania. And it's late in the afternoon, 6 o'clock at night, and we said, you know, we're going to have to excuse ourselves, that we have to give a talk down the street here. And the prime minister said, could I go with you? And we said, would you like to? And he said, yes. So we got in his cars. He had about 6 or 8 cars, all with flashing lights, and we're all coming down the street in Albania and then coming to the main hotel. And then we get out and we walk up these big stairs, and the prime minister was leading the way, and then Wayne was right behind him, and I was right behind. So go in, and the audience was stunned that the prime minister was at this meeting. And he says, I want to introduce these guys. So he introduced, and so I'm sitting with Wayne there, and I had to go first. And we hadn't been thinking about this. We had been with him since about 12 or 1 o'clock in the afternoon. This is 6 o'clock in the evening. We hadn't given this evening 5 minutes of thought, except all Wayne has to do is go look through his little folders and get out, because he's thought it through. See, so he says to me, as I'm sitting next to him, he says, so, what are you going to say? And I said, Wayne, I'll figure that out when I get up there. And Wayne turns white as a sheet. He's had to put up with so much. I hope I haven't aged the poor guy. So you know what? As I sat and when Wayne asked me to do this, I said, you know what? I want to do what I can to encourage the discouraged. Why did I come to that conclusion? Everybody that says to me, what are you going to do at the economic outlook on Thursday night? Is it going to be optimistic? Is it going to give us hope? Blah, 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 blah. And so I want to encourage the discouraged. I want to read you one paragraph out of a brand new book and see if you might think there's room for encouragement. Water, food, energy, healthcare, education, freedom, all terribly important. Where are we going? There's now a technology that can transform polluted water, salt water, or even raw sewage into high-quality drinking water for less than 1 penny a liter. So then you read the chapter about that and you say, oh my, you mean salt water, sewage water, drain water, you mean the world really maybe has a chance to move to fresh water? Do you know what that means as far as health? Do you know what, do you just realize how fortunate we are to have pipes and fresh water and flush toilets, but and to have telephones and television and transportation as we do? So so we're going to talk a little about that technology, not very long, just for a minute or two, okay? There's a Qualcomm Tricorder XPRIZE which promises this, listen to this, a low-cost, handheld medical device that allows anyone to diagnose themselves better than a board-certified doctor. Do you realize that we now have the technology called vertical farms, which replace traditional agriculture with a system that uses 80% less land, 90% less water, and 100% fewer pesticides and zero transportation costs? Well, I'm going to go on and on. I mean, look at, here's the deal. Every century has been tough. Interestingly, the 20th century has been the least tough, but the most blood. The least tough, but the most blood. In 1916, we start World War I, and there's 5 million deaths. In 1940-41, World War II starts, 70 million deaths. In the meantime, we have an influenza that goes through the world. This is in 1918. Which killed 50 million people. And you go on and you think about tsunamis that, and you think about earthquakes and so on. Oh my gosh. So the 20th century was as bloody and difficult and death-ridden as any of the centuries. More so. That's just hard to believe. But at the same time, in the 20th century, infant mortality went down by 90% throughout the world. Maternal mortality, mother dying at birth, went down by 99%. And in the 20th century, the world went from living longevity of 35 years throughout the world, you lived that long, to 70 years. So we doubled human lifetime. So we all know that when you can move to fresh water, we all know that really one of the main divides between poverty and not so poverty is a thing called electricity. And if you have electricity, it's just magnificently, this is what you can all do with electricity. Now, given that everybody then needs energy and power to make that electricity, is there going to be enough in the world? And lo and behold, we have found that if when we dig oil wells, if we'll go ahead and go a little bit deeper than 3,000 feet, if we're willing to go down there at about 7,000 feet, which is more than a mile underground, that there just seems to be a whole shale rock that if that rock can be fractured or cracked, is just bubbling with oil and gas. And so all of a sudden we find the four largest gas fields in the world, in the United States, but it's not just the United States. Even little Israel can go down and drill. And even Israel plans on being energy independent in the next 5 or 6 years. Energy independent of the whole Muslim world over there that have them surrounded. Little Israel. But it's true almost everywhere you drill, you go down there and you find this hard shale and you frack it. And you use techniques that are really pretty sophisticated. But interesting, you say, yeah, but doesn't it destroy the water supply? In one answer, no. We have fracked 1 million wells now, 1 million, and we've had problems with 10. Just like the Wright brothers had a little bit of problem with their first airplane. And just like an a technology that is going to bring energy to the world, natural gas, cleanest of the fossil fuels. The division here, dear friends, is we used to be all muscle for almost all of human history. All human muscle, ox muscle, horse muscle, muscle. That's what we were about. But when we were able to come through this thing of called fossil fuel, now one fossil fueledized 45-foot John Deere self-propelled combine can do the work of 5,000 men. Now you can use diesel fuel, pull it, put it into a diesel train, and that train can do the work of 100,000 men. You use jet fuel and you put it into a Boeing 747, and you can even set a space thing on the top of that, and off it goes, and it'll do the work of 500,000 men, that one, those jet engines on that 747. So you see where this is going. I mean, fossil fuels and energy make us productive. There's no other way to increase people's well-being other than being more productive. Do you know of a way? So energy is critical. And one might think, well, but how about all the poor? Well, I'm telling you, this is going to change. Not only can we get at some energy for them, and it'll be in the form of natural gas, which, by the way, is just a sweeter way to do electricity than is coal or nuclear. Nuclear is, for some, a bit scary, but it has to be a 1,000 or 2,000 megawatt plant. Big. Coal is dirty, as you all know. You burn coal, it's dirty. Natural gas is kind of a whole different deal. And that's what we're talking about, the kind of energy that the world is finding. So what we thought, that gosh, with 8 billion people on the planet, we're not going to have enough energy. Not so. Bottom line is this. We ended the 20th century with half of the population of the world making less than $2 a day. Poverty. We'll end the 21st century with most human beings living in relative prosperity. When you have water, when you have electricity, when you have fossil fuel, I'm telling you, you just never know where that's all going to go. And by and large, it is very exciting. Encouraging the discouraged. Well, you're going to enjoy this lesson, I'm telling you. Does pain have a purpose in us and for us? God, number one, treasures of himself in darkness so that we may know him. Were it not for pain or suffering, things that you might never know are revealed. I'm telling you, I'm going to ask Wayne to have me come back because I want to discuss this with you. It's a big, big topic, and especially some of you, and I know some of the stories, and I'm going to force you to tell the stories that there's been some pain in your life that has turned to a treasure, and I can hardly wait for the rest of the class to get to hear that. See, wouldn't this have been fun if we would have done this? Number two. Number two, God's ways are not our ways, etc. Life is not God. We don't live in Easter Sunday. We live life on Easter Saturday. Perfection and life and our body are not here yet. So that's the point. And what I'm going to do on that section is we're going to turn to Joshua 40:14, and we're going to look at old Joshua and Caleb were two of the 12 spies going in to the promised land and coming out, and 10 of the 12 report, oh no, we can't get in there. They're big, they're huge, they're mighty, and they make us look like grasshoppers. But not Joshua and not Caleb. They said, no, let's take it. But Joshua and Caleb were outvoted. And then in Joshua 14, it's 85 years later, and Joshua is reminding God, saying, God, remember when Joshua and I went in, we said we could do it, and then God says, Caleb, the time is right. Point, patience. 45 years. Caleb is now 85. Bummers! You're going to go out and take a new land at age 85, huh? Yeah, huh? Geez, so God's perspective. Now turn the page. See how we're flipping through this so fast? Suffering, pain, endurance, for Christ's sake and for others' sake. I've written a number of things that we can do it for Christ's sake. But for Christ's sake, take it on and share his suffering and keep on rejoicing. But for Christ's sake, take it on and share his suffering and keep on rejoicing. Blah, 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 blah. So, of course, the Bible gives a strong undergirding to take on pain and discouragement for his sake, but also for others' sake. You can comfort because you were comforted. So one of the things I want to do this morning, in that second paragraph in number four, God, could my suffering be used to help others? Could my affliction bring glory to your name? Lord, as I suffer, others are watching. Thank you for this opportunity to build their faith. Father, as I suffer, the angels are watching. Thanks for the strength and comfort in allowing me the privilege of causing the angels to rejoice. You know, the beautiful thing about a class that is all our age, and I'm not saying for a minute that you're all 71. I'm not saying that at all. There's a few of you that are in your late 60s. But when you're all by and large kind of getting this age, I'm telling you, there's a number of things that go on. And one of the things that go on is you begin to see the reality of God's touching your life the way he did. Younger, you can't understand it. Younger, you scream back. Younger, God, why are you doing this? Blah, 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 blah. Yeah, God, I'm going to bail out on you. I'm done with you. I've had it. You owed me this one. You know, we do that in our youth. But in our age and wisdom, as God is preparing our hearts for heaven itself, we see God's hand in what he's doing. Mandy and I, far, far, far from having it as difficult as some of you who have stories to tell. So I don't tell this one to even come close to topping your story. But our story the last few years is one hip replacement, and then a second one, and now in January, end of January, first knee replacement, and sometime in February, as soon as we could get through that one. And then on top of all that, Mandy had cancer surgery. So, you know what? You could look at that and say, bummer. Bummer. End of skiing, end of this, blah, 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 blah. But you know what? Instead, you get up this morning, and your precious wife of 15 years says, honey, I'm just hurting so bad. Could you get the heating pad and put it on me? And instead of clawing back, why are you doing this to us, God? You say, God, you're doing this to us because last night, as we take my 96-year-old dad to dinner and eat with some friends, we got to say some things that at the end of the evening, they're younger, they said, thank you. This is really going to help us through this trial that we're going through with our son. And you just say, oh God, if we wouldn't have had the same discouragements and difficulties and trials and pushed to the line, we maybe would have had nothing to say. But we get to share our experiences and our life. And the interesting thing is, at 71, you've had more life than you do when you're 30 years old. God, for others' sake, for others' sake. Lastly, embracing the gift of pain with hope, embracing the gift of pain with learning to wait. Learning to wait. You younger folks, not very good at it. You get older. Maine and I have done more waiting in doctors' waiting rooms than at hospitals than we've ever done in our life. And when the doctor comes in, you've been there all day, it's 5:30, he says, I'm sorry, I've been, he's not been goofing around, trust me. He's not been playing in golf. He has been working his fat tail off all day long. But I thought I owed him an observation. No, that's okay, Doc. That's okay. But it really would have been nice if we would have caught this illness in an earlier stage. I felt a need to tell him that. It was a joke. He kind of laughed about as much as you did there. Embracing the gift of pain with hope, with learning to wait, I can promise you, the next time Wayne Grudem is traveling, I'm coming back, and we're going to hear some of your stories, and we're going to do this. Father in heaven, be with Wayne this week as they're going through this funeral with his father. Thanks for Wayne's dad. Without Wayne's dad, we wouldn't have had Wayne. Boy, are we appreciative of his dad and that he got to live to a ripe old age, and you've taken him home. God, there's going to be lots of rejoicing at that funeral. Lord, the individuals that are sitting in this room this very moment, that have a trial or a difficulty or a pain or a depression. It feels like a big cave. It feels like I can't get out. It's very, very, very uncomfortable. Lord, would you lift their spirits today? Would you have them see that some of this is going to be translated in changing other people's lives and affecting other people's lives and encouraging other people's lives? It's ennobling. Lord, we have to be real. The pain hurts. It doesn't go away because we snap a finger. And certainly it does not go away in our timing. So many of the characters in the Bible, including Caleb, including Job, including many, had a wonderful patience. Waiting. 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 We would like to think that waiting is no fun. But Lord, are there some lessons that we can learn in this pain and this hurt? Lord, help us to understand that the sooner that we can go serve someone, even with all this pain, and it's dragging us down and it's putting us down, but if we can serve someone today, it will be beneficial. Lord, thanks for your precious word and for this class and for their precious teacher, Wayne. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.